Well, this has been quite a November weather-wise, hasn't it? It seems like the nice temperatures, the warm temperatures, were here to stay. We had a recent snowfall, but here we are in southern Wisconsin with a lot of rain, at least last night, and we have no snow.
What and the is that a good thing or a bad? Well, I know yeah. John thinks it's a bad thing, but
is that a reasonable question?
Steve Ackerman and John Martin with us, our weather guys. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW, and is also, of course, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And again, Steve, welcome back. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
And John Martin, thank you. John, professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Good to see you, too.
Good to see you, Larry. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have lots of things we can talk about today, but that warm weather, why are we having so much warm weather this time of the year?
Mm. Good question.
Yeah, well, 2015 has all been a really warm weather. In fact, it's predicted and probably will be the warmest one on record as we're going along. And Wisconsin's been the same thing. All month it's been 4 or 5 degrees above normal throughout most of the state.
Yeah, and we had, 6 degrees above normal almost for October?
Yeah.
We had two back-to-back beautiful really months across the state. Just absolutely beautiful. High amplitude flow, characteristic of this time of year. Sometimes you're on the wrong side of it. Sometimes you're on the right side of it. I'd say we were on the right side of it most of the time this year. But that doesn't really answer the question. Of course, it begs the question. How did that work out? And that's something you usually can't figure out in real time. You got to go back and think about it after it happened and see if you can't figure it out. That's what we're trying to do.
Now, what's amplitude flow?
Well, usually the flow around the hemisphere is close to east to west, with little variations with northerly and southerly flow kind of mixed in on a small, small percentage. But when it gets to be high amplitude, then I'd say the flow is at least as north-south as it is east-west, and maybe even more north-south than east-west when it's really high amplitude. And I think that's been characteristic of the weather over at least the western hemisphere for a good part of October and November. And the consequence is, if you're in the poleward-directed side of that, the air comes from warm locations. If you're on the equator-directed side of that, it comes from cold locations. And we've been on the poleward-directed side for much of those 2 months.
Yeah.
Our guests today, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, I didn't give the numbers. Let me do that right now. If you have a question about weather or climate, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Any weather or climate question is always welcome. What about, the weather, I mean, is this the way the winter's going to go? I mean,
They're looking at a warmer than normal winter because of the El Nino. We have a pretty good El Nino developing in the Pacific Ocean. And in the past, strong El Ninos usually meant that the upper Midwest is warmer than normal. And that's kind of where we're headed for this winter anyway.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably right.
And we've talked about this in the past, but I think it's worth repeating. What exactly is El Nino?
So an El Nino is actually something that happens in the equatorial Pacific Oceans, where normally you have warm waters to the western part of the Pacific Oceans. And then that warm water, there's a weakening in the atmospheric circulations, and that warm water sloshes back to the eastern Pacific Ocean. And with that comes a bunch of precipitation and a change in the normal global circulation pattern, the waves that John was just talking about.
Yeah.
And those wave patterns generally put us in a warming condition as opposed to a colder condition, which probably occurs Siberia, Europe.
Yeah. Where does it get colder? I think it gets colder in Siberia. That's right. I think that's right.
So they're the... that's just what they need in Siberia.
Yeah, it's already the coldest place in the Northern Hemisphere. Why not make it colder?
Yeah.
Right. Why not get a little bit colder? You know, there's some pretty cool work that's being done here at Wisconsin Public Radio through something called Wiscontext. It's a series about El Nino and Wisconsin, which I think is really cool. We've got a link to it on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. It's wpr.org/series/El Nino - Wisconsin. So, and I think I'm sure we have a link to it. And I really like the idea of it. So there's a number of great topics on how El Nino's impact North America, of course, but how they might impact Wisconsin wildlife, or how tourism industry may be impacted, or logging, or our energy bills, or and then another one on the climate research that's going on. So I think it's really kind of a cool place to go. It's a series of, I think it's 13 parts in this package.
Oh, so nice.
Sounds very interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely worth a look for sure. And nice segments from something we call Wisconcontext series. Jill and Racine has a question for you guys. Let's go there. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Larry. I'm in Racine, Wisconsin right now, and we seem to handle the snow real well. And we go to Texas for a part of the winter. Why can't Texas handle their water? It floods time after time after time again.
Yeah, that's a good question. One of the things I remember as a boy was watching the terrible drought, I think it was 1979 or 1980 in the summertime, that was abruptly ended by Hurricane David or Allison. I can't remember the year, but anyway, it was one of those first of the season almost tropical cyclones, and they'd had a long, long drought in eastern Texas. The ground turns into cement there when it gets dry. And so when the water falls, and it rains heavily down there, many times of the year, not just tropical storms, and if the ground has been parched up to that point, it rolls off as if it were cement. And so that contributes to flooding. So that's one of the reasons. I don't know if it's the only reason, but it certainly is one of the reasons. The soil is just predisposed almost to reacting to prolonged droughts and then a substantial flood or rain on top of it in that way.
And it's been a kind of a boom and bust in terms of droughts in Texas.
Yeah, and that's the nature of that part of the globe anyway. You know, even the vegetation demonstrates that it goes into hibernation for water, lack of water, and then it blooms right again as soon as it's wet.
Yeah.
So.
And then it's also flat.
And
right?
Flat.
So that once it
get
rains, but sloping, right?
Yeah.
So it's
a
like
flat,
you know,
sloping flat.
Yeah.
So around here, when we do get a lot of rain and precipitation, it all funnels into the river valleys, and then you get flooding there. Where if you don't have that, if it's flat, it just goes everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, they can measure it, but at 8 or 10 feet, I know I'm underwater.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's for sure. Jill, I hope that answers your question. And it doesn't solve the problem, but it answers your question.
Right, yeah.
There you go.
But if you just moved to Racine, you moved the right direction.
Yeah, that's right.
It went the right way, that's for sure. Well, the rains that we've had in southern Wisconsin, like overnight, that pretty much, I would assume, just sunk into the... percolated into the earth.
Yeah, I don't think the ground's frozen
yet,
and so it does absorb. And that's what happened with that snowfall we had, too, and a lot of the, you know, like driveways and roadways, the snow really didn't stick because the ground's pretty warm.
Yeah, and the point about no frozen ground is a big deal for heavy rain in the wintertime here.
Yeah.
It's not frozen, it does percolate.
I mean, we had record precipitation down here in Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah, that's what you said
really
on the way
have
over,
any,
yeah.
Much flooding around. So.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a Facebook question from Marcus, who says, since the jet streams steers the weather patterns, wouldn't you think that the TV weather people would talk about it more and show graphics of the jet stream?
Yeah, Tom Skilling does on WGN, and I talked to him about it. He says, well, you know, if you do this for 30 years and you're really good at it like he is, he didn't say that. He's way too modest, but that was the implication. He earned himself 8.5 minutes. He gets the longest broadcast on television weather in the whole country for a regular network show. And that gives him the time to explain things in detail and even bring in things like the jet stream, which is great because people are hungry to understand these things. That's one thing I think we've learned over all these years is that this is not a disinterested public. Everybody's interested in the weather at one level or another. So I've always advocated it should be much longer and much more involved than it is, the discussion of the weather. So the caller has a really good question. Were it up to me, it'd be a 5-minute segment where you'd be talking about that.
Well, you're a little biased.
Yeah, I'm a little biased.
and the local folks do show it now and then, usually, because I know I've seen it, particularly when there is uncertainty in like the 2 or 3 day forecast where they seem to be flopping around a lot, then they'll show the two different types of positions of where the jet stream might be and why it's a tough forecast.
And I just to congratulate the local television stations, I think the weather people here... in the Madison market, for example, are good people.
They're
I mean, they're highly educated.
Yeah.
Really do a pretty good job.
Yeah, well, a fair number of them totally we had in our own program. So, and we're proud of them. They're darn good. And I get to tell them that whenever I get a chance, I make sure I do.
Yeah. And they're fun people too.
Yeah, that's true.
Fun but to hang out with.
But if you have access to WGN television sometime, the news, it's kind of fun to see.
Yeah.
Tom Skilling is.
Well, he has a Wisconsin connection.
Yeah.
University of Wisconsin
that's right.
connection.
Well, yeah. He was a weather person here on one of the local stations for a time.
Right.
Short time. Richard in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. This is a kind of follow-up on the flooding in Texas.
Okay.
During the drought, 5.6 million trees died. And without those root systems in place, it not only was the soil like concrete, there's nothing to hold the water.
Yeah, nothing sucks it up. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, absolutely. How many trees did you think?
5.6 million, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
That is an amazing number. So... another reason why I live in Wisconsin.
Yeah,
Kansas.
Right. This is a really good point, though. This is a very interactive process. You know, anything that discusses weather and climate, you can instantly start to get yourself into biological responses and interactions with the climate and the weather and all that, just as your caller points out. Really excellent point.
Yeah.
Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. We had an email question from Paul. Paul's heading to Samoa this winter, 14 degrees south of equator, towards Fiji, 1,500 miles north of North Island, New Zealand. What are weather effects in that area from the warmer ocean? More rain? I'm sure you've been checking on this morning.
Well, yeah. I'll tell you I haven't because I'm never going to Samoa. So even though I'd like to. So I suspect that any of those land masses in the South Pacific, the warmer the water gets surrounding them, it might increase the frequency of afternoon thunderstorms or something like that. I'm not really
that's
what I know
for
sure.
To, probably like Hawaii. Hawaii's north of the equator, but you know, you get those afternoon rains. They develop and they rain out, and that's why it's the rainbow state.
Yeah,
a lot of little shatters.
I was thinking back of living in Trinidad. It always rained in the morning, early morning in Trinidad. I think
the
clouds had come in. From Venezuela, and then sort of get stalled on the northern mountain range, and then when the sun came up or whatever, they got over it.
Probably sea breeze land breeze, one or the other, one part of that circulation
system.
Little,
not a lot, but just almost every morning you'd have a little bit of rain, which was fine with me.
Right.
I didn't mind it. I was on my way to work anyway, so I didn't care.
I will predict this about Samoa, though, is that the temperature will be warmer than up here.
That's a
I would go for that.
I would say that's true.
You can rest assured.
Less snowfall, probably.
Yeah. And we've got some other questions coming up here. Karen wonders about the humidity and why it's usually higher in Antigo than it is in Bayfield, and I'm going to let our weather guys ponder that. A little bit. Steve Ackerman from the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies in UW-Madison and John Martin, Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Join in with your weather climate questions at 1-800-642-1234. We'll take a quick look at the weather and then we will be and news and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at weather and climate with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison and also directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. John Martin, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. So it's always fun to have our weather guys come by the last Monday of every single month. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And let's take up that email question from Karen, who wonders, why is the humidity usually higher in Antigo than it is in Bayfield? It's easier to get. Is it easier to get moisture off the land than it is off the big lake? And of course, Bayfield is located right on Lake Superior, whereas Anago is sort of in our Central Sands area, with not a whole lot of water around it.
Yeah, so we talked about it, and there's two things going on. One is whether or not the observations, instrument observations, are actually showing that, or does it appear that way? We can certainly imagine it appearing that way, because while Bayfield is right on Lake Superior, it's Lake Superior is really cold. And so in the summertime in particular, when you get the breeze come off the lake onto the land there, that's going to feel cool and feel very low humidity, dryness. You're not going to feel hot. Whereas in the middle or just north of the middle of Wisconsin, you're going to get that warm air, humidity, evaporation from the ground, particularly if there's a lot of marshlands around or vegetations, potatoes in particular.
Yeah, and if they're irrigated. Another thing, that, not so much corn is grown up there, Larry was telling us, but potatoes. But nonetheless, the plants transpirate water vapor back to the atmosphere. So if you're irrigating them and artificially giving them liquid water, they lose a lot of water vapor back to the atmosphere. It's a good reason why Waterloo, Iowa, has always got the highest dew point of just about any place around here on a hot summer day, because there's so much irrigation going on. It might as well be an inland sea. So it's a, that's true. John Norman told me that.
Right. Yeah.
Iowa is a, might as well be a 6-inch deep inland sea in mid-July.
It does, because of the corn.
The corn does such a bad job of managing water, it just transpires it right back to the atmosphere after it's been irrigated.
Yeah.
Well, Dave in La Crosse has a different kind of question, so let's go there. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I keep hearing that about close to half the public doesn't believe in global warming because they don't understand it. And I was just wondering if you're aware of any public demonstrations that are accurate. I know that a lot of them they've tried are pretty much flawed because they're trying to do it with Coke bottles and thermometers and light bulbs and so on. And I just wonder if you know of any good public demonstrations online.
Boy,
red absorption.
Yeah, so I'll tell you what I like to do, but of course a lot of it also has to go with the verbiage and the discussion afterwards. But when you're talking about global warming, you're really talking about greenhouse gases, and we're really looking at the Earth as a system. And so if you look at the Earth as a system, then the environment is space. And the only way that the Earth as a system then exchanges energy with its environment, space, is through absorbing solar energy that's coming from the sun and then emitting long wave or terrestrial energy out to space. And what a greenhouse gas does is that as you add the greenhouse gas to the atmosphere, it doesn't at all impact the amount of solar energy that it absorbs. What it impacts is the amount of long wave energy that the surface emits. It absorbs more of that. And so the way that I like to demonstrate it, and this probably has a lot of faults as well, is with a hot plate. So that's one fault, because you're in a classroom with a hot plate. People can touch it. And if you hold that hot plate on the side and you have somebody put their hand in front of it, you can see all, you can feel all that radiant energy absorbed by the hand. And then I just like to put a piece of glass or a piece of plastic in between that's transparent to all visible light. And so you can still see through it, but it quickly absorbs the infrared radiation that's coming off that hot plate. And you can physically feel it on your hand.
It's amazing how quickly you do. You feel it almost feel like it's getting colder, and it's not.
Right,
it's just not getting hot anymore. It's amazing. So,
I mean, that's one demonstration, but it also has its fault because it also absorbs it. I mean, the solar energy also has a lot of wavelengths that we don't see yet, and it turns out plastic absorbs it those as well.
Yeah.
So you're and you have referenced in the past the number of scientists who have are on the bandwagon of global warming. I don't know if bandwagon is probably the wrong word.
Yeah, probably not the right word because it's
not
science,
right.
Really.
It's science. And I mean that's something that Dave could certainly mention to people who aren't.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's just so many different angles by which you can approach that problem. It's funny that we're gathering, and the world leaders are gathering in Paris this week. They're not gathering to argue about whether or not there's a problem. They're arguing about what we're going to do. So the question of whether or not something's happening is already long solved, and there's no room for dispute about that. There's plenty of room for a really intelligent, sober conversation about how do we deal with it. What are some strategies by which we make the future a little bit brighter? But there's no question at all that human activity that's changed the composition of the atmosphere to increase the number of the fraction of gases that do just what Steve says, absorb outgoing radiation but let the incoming come in as if it weren't there, is a factor. It's a real problem.
Yeah. And the only ones who really doubt it are the ones who don't want to face that tough problem of what do we do about it.
Right. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dave, for calling. Dan in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I had a question. Maybe it's similarly related to the greenhouse gas and stuff, but I have a thermometer in my attic. I always wanted to keep the check on the temperature. And in the wintertime, I guess I've noticed that if it's 35 degrees outside in the morning, it's like 30 degrees in the attic. So how can the attic get colder than the outside temperature if there's nothing cooling it off?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Well, I'll say this as an observational meteorologist. Number one, I don't trust the fact that you got two different thermometers. If you report the same thing using the same thermometer, then we've got then that's something we got to explain.
So you should take the two thermometers together and go outside and
make sure they're calibrated.
Oh.
Because if they're not, then that would be part of the answer. But if they are calibrated, that's a really good question. I guess I don't really know what the answer would be right off the top of my head.
I would take a guess. One guess might be that you have really good insulation on the floor of the attic so that there's not heat coming from the house up into the attic. Mm. And overnight, the temperature is going to be cooler and cool down. And I would think that it would take longer for the inside of that attic than to warm up.
Yeah, so if you're not measuring it right at the coolest point of the night, that would be another thing. That's possible, too. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's a really good question. There's a bunch of very interesting.
It's not what I would expect.
Yeah,
it's not what I would expect.
Me either. And I don't mean to suggest, Dan, that it's definitely the thermometer, but it is the first thing that pops into my mind. If you did a calibration and still had this problem to solve, that'd be even
more. Well, you could take the two thermometers, couldn't you, and calibrate
side by side.
Yeah, do them side by side.
See if there's any bias in one of them. And then if there is no bias, or even if you measure the bias and it's only a degree and you're seeing 5-degree differences, then I would spend a couple of days of waking up at 1, 2, 3 in the morning, going up there and doing the comparisons to see if it's what Larry's suggestion, where it's
a
changing rates and cooling down and warming up.
Yeah, I think that's a good problem.
Yeah. Very cool. Thanks a lot for
calling. Let us know what you find out.
I'm betting that my answer is the right one. I've had so many shows on insulation and dealing with that kind of issue that that's the first thing that popped into my mind anyway. What popped into your mind? You have a question for us? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Eileen and Baraboo, what's on your mind?
I'm interested in having a longer weather report nationwide on either the Weather Channel or with the major NBC, ABC channels. It seems like they skim over Arizona and Colorado and Montana, North Dakota. And I know sometimes there's not much going on in these places, but sometimes there is. And it seems like in from Wisconsin, we get tons of weather reports here, but we don't have any idea what's really going on. If you want to take a side trip up to who knows where, Nebraska, for instance, what kind of weather you're going to be
What you're going to be getting.
I don't think we're going to argue with you about that. But we don't run a business either.
I'm at 100% in your camp. I think it's probably just, the mandate to appeal to a local audience. But that local audience includes people like you who want to know what's going on around the country. If you can come by Friday at noon, every Friday during our academic year, you can see a full-blown weather discussion about the national weather and hemispheric weather, too. So I know you can't, but if you could, it'd be great. You'd love it.
And I'll tell you this, it's better than it was 25 years ago, right? Because now if you can get to the internet, you can get that information from National Weather Service sites.
Yeah. Well, typically what happens, that I'm really like Canada. I spend a lot of time in Saskatchewan, so I'll type in weather in Saskatoon.
All right, yeah.
Or where my favorite golf course in Saskatchewan is located, and I'll get the what their local weather says.
Yeah, if we're traveling to a city, I always, you know, get that city on my weather app so that you can fire it up and see what the 3-day outlook is.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim and Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, just a comment of the guy saying that the attic is always colder. If you take the same thermal gun, which I'll do, and shoot the side of your car and then the roof of your car, before the sun comes up is so much colder because it radiates straight up. That's why you need so much more insulation in your attic, because your attic radiates straight up, you know, from your roof.
And if I could follow up on that with regard to cars again, this is why frost forms on that front windshield. And not on the sides. It's because the front windshield is tilted.
Ah, there we go. Thanks,
Jim.
Just
a little comment on, you know, you said that, you know, don't trust the thermometers. Don't trust even electronic humidity gauges, because they're all different. You get like six of them, you line them up, and they're all off.
Oh, humidity? Yeah, I've heard humidity is even worse than temperature, in terms of calibration. Yeah, that's interesting to hear. That's nice confirmation.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. It was like the old story, which isn't doesn't hold water anymore, but it was like, what was the old saying? If you had a watch, you always knew what time it was, but if you had two watches, you never knew what time it was.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Warren and Kakana next. Hi, Warren. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. A question on global warming. I was wondering if it's all man-made causes of global warming, or if like volcanoes and things would have just as much effect on the change of the climate, and how that also relates to like our ice ages and the long history of climate change down the earth.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling.
There are a number of physical factors that have been involved in altering the Earth's climate over long periods of time, and you mentioned a couple of them. Volcanoes certainly do. They put in aerosol particles and various other constituents into the atmosphere. I'd say their biggest climate impact is from aerosols, and they tend to cool the planet a little bit because they block out incoming solar radiation. And then there are orbital changes. The Earth doesn't go around the sun in the same amount of time. Over geologic time, its axis is tilted over at different angles over long periods of time as well. These occur over hundreds of thousands of years, I believe, something like that. However, the current warming that we've experienced in the last 150 years seems very directly tied to the burning of fossil fuels and the change in the composition of the atmosphere, which has been wrought by humankind. One of the really nice glove-in-hand pieces of evidence for that is the fact that the atmospheric oxygen, molecular oxygen reservoir has decreased in the last 100 years, or the last 50 years. That's been measured really accurately at exactly the same rate as the burning of fossil fuels would have suggested it should decrease. And we're not in any danger of losing our atmospheric oxygen reservoir, but it is interesting to know it's gone down at the exact same rate that one would predict from burning the inventory of fossil fuels, a global business that's well accounted for. That's a perfect piece of evidence in my mind that says that's what's driving the current change in the atmosphere's composition.
Interesting. Thank you, Warren, for calling. Appreciate your call. Sort of an aside, I was reading somewhere in Brazil now is facing much less rainfall than the rainfall has dropped considerably, and some people are suggesting that it's because of the rainforest being taken out.
I read that article, too, and it's really fascinating. And again, it goes back to a comment John made earlier about the interaction between the biosphere and the atmosphere. And so, the forests down there actually do a lot of transpiration and moving water vapor into the atmosphere, which then becomes the source for precipitation. And what they were finding is, when you cut down the trees and put grasslands there, you don't have that kind of transpiration, and thus you don't have the moisture source for the precipitation.
And I just read this in a different article or heard it from somebody at a seminar on campus here not more than 2 weeks ago. Some large fraction, I don't know if I'm right, if it's 30% or something amazing like that, of the water that falls on the rainforest never reaches the ground and remains on the leaves and on the trees to be evaporated again. So if you take those things out, that's 30% of that total precipitation that's now available and wasn't prior to this is available for percolation into the ground. And some fraction of that goes away forever.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting how that feeds back.
Yeah.
Dick in Burnhamwood has a question, so let's go to him. Dick, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. basic question is why the predictions, the weather predictions, when you go to the different sources, seem to be different. I would have thought these guys are all going to the same source for their data. I mean, for example, you go on the Internet, you go to IntelliCast, or you go to NOAA, and their predictions quite often are quite different. Same thing on TV, the different channels have different predictions. I mean, how is it they differ so much?
I guess it depends. In my mind, it depends on the variable that you're talking about. If it turns to snowfall, then a lot of people will try and nuance the output from numerical weather prediction models to try and make the best guess about what they think personally. It becomes quite personal then about snowfall amounts. Other than that, I don't find that the variance is gigantic, except in certain events. It's not characteristically very big, but it certainly is occasionally. And that can just be an individual forecaster's decision or their particular vigilance about which of the solutions that are presented as possible guidance are the ones to be trusted that day. That's more of an opinion based upon their own monitoring of recent performance. And some people are more vigilant about that than others. And so that might account for some of the variation. But I think you're right. Generally, they all do go to look at, you know, many of the same sources in the process of trying to determine what it is they're going to tell the public.
I mean, is there any reason to believe that NOAA, for example, is better than IntelliCast or anything like that?
Well, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where the Weather Service resides, is actually the progenitor of all the forecast information. So a company like IntelliCast is a private company. They use government-paid-for model results to base their forecasts on, generally. You know, they may have some niche products themselves. So, you know, I think NOAA has more of the raw materials at its disposal than some of the private companies. But that doesn't necessarily mean they'll make the better forecast on a given day. But overall, I think I would trust the Weather Service before I'd trust a company.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I got an email from Karen who says, how can we believe that sea levels will rise when they have not risen so far and warmists have been predicting this for 20 years? New York was supposed to be underwater by now. I don't think that's the case.
No, and actually the sea level has been rising. The observations of both tidal gauges as well as satellites have shown that it has risen. Not at, you know, what people would consider to be a lot, you know, a few centimeters, a couple of inches. But so it doesn't sound like it's a lot, but actually that's a lot of water.
Right,
when you look at all the coastlines.
I read an article recently about, actually in Florida, there are companies that are looking at, and some agencies within government are looking at what's going to happen.
I think it goes to what John was saying earlier, you know, about what's going on in Paris right now with the meetings. But it's not just the government officials and organizations that are looking at and planning for change. It's private industries.
Yeah.
It's the armed forces.
Yeah.
So when people talk about it's not happening, you can say it's not happening, but it's happening. And people are planning for it.
Right. And go talk to the insurance and reinsurance companies.
Yeah,
see if they think it's happening.
Right. Cities are hopefully planning for it. Some are, some aren't. But.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, the majority of folks who look to the future and have to invest in the future are accounting for what's happening with global warming. And what does that mean?
Exactly, correct.
What's the variations?
So it's only at the political level.
It's only at the political level, and it's because they don't want to take on the hard work that needs to be done. I mean, that's not easy to determine how much money are you going to spend in order to protect your city. You know, particularly when the protection you're talking about is going to occur 30, 50 years out from now, and nobody wants to pay for it, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, this
need leadership.
Had to do with Miami.
Yeah, well, Miami's out close to the coastline. another flat area.
We don't have a plethora of Floridian politicians being quite nervous about what's coming, and that seems surprising to me. It's their own home state.
Right.
They're
they should
nervous.
Be a little worried about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, they should be.
Or at least planning and talking about what the options are.
I agree.
Is there, Bill wonders, by the way, about the dew, let's go to dew points for a minute. How's a dew point computed?
Dew points, you can measure it with a psychrometer. It's a thermometer that has two thermometers. One of them, you put a wet wick, cloth wick on it. You swing it around so that it evaporates and it gives you a temperature that it would be if the water were evaporated in the air temperature. You use those two numbers to figure out the dew point on a chart. You could also measure the humidity in another way and use the same type of chart to figure out what your dew point temperature is.
Or another cool way to do it is you have a plate, and then you cool that plate. And then as soon as dew forms, that's your dew point temperature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go. And Todd in Cross Plains, You know what, Todd? I'm just going to kind of ask this question for you. I'm wondering if Black Earth Creek Valley can create a microclimate, creating a difference in weather for areas around it.
I would say definitely could cause a microclimate, which is a small area. I mean, a lot of times when you're in the summertime in particular, as you're up on a ridge and you walk down into a creek or a river area, all of a sudden it feels cooler.
Right. You could find a ball field, let's say, in one of those valleys that's definitely colder than the one across town every night of the summer. Yeah, absolutely right.
And Todd, I'm sorry I couldn't get you on to ask that question, but we're out of time. And you know what? Next time we talk, it'll be about the end of December.
It'll be the end of the year. We'll be able to talk about all the great things.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you guys so much.
Well, thank you.
Look forward to their next visit, our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Always great to have them along, and they will be back. Tomorrow we'll take a look at domestic violence as an issue around the state at 11. Then at 11:45, we're going to talk about a new book out about empathy, why it matters, and how to get it. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay listening.